When we hear a story about crime and justice, most of us are guilty of a bad habit. The need for simplicity in the narrative. Good guys, bad guys, a fitting punishment, justice served. The thing is, when you reach only for what's easy to process, you get thin stories, lacking nuance, often absent of humanity. The correction system is filled with people with full lives and relationships, affected in big and small ways by the time they spent behind bars. I took the road less complicated in thinking about incarcerated people until about a decade ago. I was a budding feminist researcher and spent my senior year of college documenting experiences of a group of formerly incarcerated women. They had all taken part in a writing and performance project while they were serving time. And through conversations with them, I started to trouble my own understanding of life inside and outside prison. Each of these women's stories was full in its messy humanity. Relationships gone wrong, love found and lost, friends who stood by them, others who let them down, systems that separated them from their kids, and now an attempt to build a new life on the outside. All of it showed me that if we keep asking the same questions about life inside and outside prison, we'll keep telling the same stories. It's time to ask some new questions. This is Embodied. I'm Anita Rao.
They called us the Jay-Z and Beyonce of SCI Chester, of the prison.
Here in the U.S., we incarcerate people at a higher rate than any other country in the world. When someone serves a sentence, their families and loved ones suffer punishment too. Yet despite the hardship, relationships persist inside and outside prison walls. Adriel and Monet Alvarado have one of the most unlikely love stories I've heard in a long time. They met on the inside when they were both serving time in a Pennsylvania prison.
Yeah, we would go to the corner of the yard and we used to sit there and go to the moon. We used to talk about everything.
We was never tired of each other.
Monet and Adriel snuck around to find space for intimacy and even found ways to go on dates, getting really creative in their environment.
Remember one time we got them covering us in the yard?
Oh, black. I forgot about that. We made a wall of people
to block the camera and the staff. Have them just standing around so they can like actually like block.
Make a wall.
Yeah, make a wall basically. So we could like, you know, sneak a little blowjob here.
Although their circumstances seem far removed from most love stories, Adriel and Monet first met in a classic location for budding romance.
Well, we met in a laundry room. And
sounds weird, but I worked in laundry. And she came to get some clothes. You got to explain it. We met in the laundry room.
I was coming back from getting my fan that I purchased from commissary. And I wanted to stop at the laundry room. That's where he worked at. But my intention was to go get some new clothes, some crispy, clean clothes. You know, state issue uniform. And I got in there, started talking to a couple people. That's when he came up to me and approached me. And then he asked me about my eyebrows. And how did I do my eyebrow? I used to draw my eyebrow with a big pen.
Yep.
It was nice though. It looked real.
It was.
So I told him that, and then he was surprised and shy, like, "Oh wow, it looked amazing." And that's when I kind of know he was interested. I just know he was into me, so I kind of like went for it. I kind of like not chase after him, but I got moved to his unit because we was in a separate unit before we got
separated.
Yeah, before we got separated into a different tower, we was in the same tower. We started writing each other.
Yeah.
Started talking. And it just, I don't know.
We built up fast.
Yeah, we did.
Because what I think is we was both missing something. You know, and when we both realized that the other person had something we needed, I guess we connected.
Yeah, we connected fast.
Right.
We fell in love fast, so
yeah.
We started talking about marriage and everything.
You know where I proposed to her at? in the yard in front of 1,000 inmates. In the middle of 1,000 inmates. These are serial killers, murderers, rapists, drug dealers, in front of everybody.
By the criminals.
For the whole criminal. Yep.
Monet and Adriel were incarcerated together in a men's prison just outside of Philadelphia, SCI Chester. During Monet's sentencing, she made it clear that she is a woman and wanted to be sent to a women's prison. But that didn't happen. Being trans in a men's prison meant Monet faced harassment and physical violence from staff and fellow inmates. Once she started dating Adriel, he started facing some of the same. Still, they tend to look on the bright side. And while some people punished them for their differences, others were inspired.
Yeah, there was people that came out of the closet because of our strength.
Gangsters too, like known gangsters. Like, and I'll be like, we helped you get your, find your inner you.
We'll write each other a note. When we see each other in the hallway, we'll pass a note, or we'll like tell each other like, hey.
Or now we'll have somebody, hey, you're going over there. If you see such and such, can you give them this?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was like 1700s, just sending letters and waiting back for a response.
But when Adriel and Monet were both in solitary, they took their communication technology to the next level.
Every time we went to the hole, there was either, a moment that we just bonded real, connected. And this is weird. We used to write letters because sometimes we didn't want to scream out because we got to talk through the door. She'll be in one cell, I'll be in another cell. So if I wanted to talk, I'll have to scream out the door and everybody else could hear. You know, so to keep that private, we will tie string to like a piece of envelope and we'll fish it across to one another, and we'll send letters back and forth like that. So she'll tie her string to my string, and we'll just back and forth letters and magazines and newspapers. Primitive, that we call that texting.
Perfecting their love letter writing was important practice for what was to come. Monet was released while Adriel remained inside. Their relationship continued while apart.
It was hard being apart, just doing things by myself. I had to get a job. I worked two jobs because, I had to send him money when he's needed for commissary. Also send him books that he needs just to keep him sane inside. And I'll write him a letter, like every other day, I'll write him a letter and send it to him just so he can
have something to read.
Yes. He's always stressing.
Monet and Adriel's love story isn't over. We'll come back to them a little bit later in the episode. But first, let's meet another couple whose relationship persisted for years despite prison walls.
Steven's my first love. Mm. And so for me, I was just like, I don't care if this is the rest of my life. Like, I want to be with him. I love him. And, this is the sacrifice I'm going to make for me to be happy.
So Tina and Stephen Green weren't involved when Stephen was first locked up, but their history goes back all the way to junior high. They were young lovers. And after a divorce, Sutina reached back out to Stephen. At the time, Stephen was serving a life sentence without possibility of parole.
I wrote letters here and there and we remained friends. I went through a divorce. And so I started writing Stephen again just to see how he was doing. And our relationship picked up from there back in 2001.
I was extremely excited and happy. I just didn't know how long it was going to last. That's kind of the sad thing about it. Relationships like those walls are built in prison. They're not built just to keep people in. They're also built to keep people out. And so I think there's this wear down effect that happens with the relationships. So even though her writing and her wanting maybe to reconnect and to come visit, I always felt that like it was one day going to be like, I can't do this anymore.
No matter the strength of their love or the honesty in their communication, Stephen's imprisonment meant the relationship would always be unbalanced.
Well, I would say that, these relationships that sometimes they can be very one-sided, or like I like to say, she has all the power because she was on the outside and I was on the inside. And so our relationship was one of economics, where if she didn't have money, then we weren't talking. And if she did have money, then we would talk, right? And that's just with dealing with like the phone calls.
Mm.
But that, and if you go into the visiting area, like you're able to visit, that takes money. And she didn't have money like that. And she was a single mom, you know, raising five kids.
From the very beginning, there was a push and pull in their expectations. Let's go back to their first date. After dozens of letters, Satina proposed coming to visit so they could see each other for the first time in years. Stephen accepted with mountains of hesitant hope. Visitation time was approved. Stephen cleaned up and made sure he looked his sharpest, and he walked into the visitation room where loved ones and families were waiting. And Satina wasn't there. Stephen, so what were you feeling after that first visit didn't go as planned?
I felt that that was normal, right? Mm-hmm. Like that maybe she had the second guessing of her own decisions and, you know, grew cold feet, so to speak. And it was, you know, pretty much like, this is how it's going to be. Like, you know, what do I expect when I'm sentenced to life without? Like, who do I expect to dedicate their life to me, right? And I don't mean that in any disrespectful way. Obviously, I love my wife, but I just don't understand it. And so this is like one of the things, like the matters of the heart doesn't always have to make sense, I think.
Satina had a valid reason for missing their date. Her family had gotten in a car accident, and she had no way to reach Stephen on short notice to cancel. Despite getting stood up and justifying his fears, Stephen gave Satina a second chance. The relationship grew. But the thing is, while Adrielle and Monet could sneak around to spend time together, Satina and Stephen's time together physically was very constrained.
It's one kiss and hug at the beginning of the visit and one kiss and hug at the end. We were fortunate enough that we were able to sit next to each other. Mm. So we could hold hands. We played games. Clothing was very strict. There was certain colors you couldn't wear, certain type of clothes you couldn't wear. So basically I had created my own prison. You know, this is what I wore for prison visiting, and then this is what I wore for everyday life. So I had my own prison wardrobe. Definitely visiting, they make it not pleasurable.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of restrictions of things you can and can't do.
With visits limited, letter writing is a non-negotiable. But it doesn't just have to be sappy "I miss you" notes. Monet would slip into some lingerie and send over whole photo books to Adrielle.
The letter could just have a picture in it. As long as I see that name, you know, coming to me.
He's always looking forward to my letter.
You know, so that means a lot. That means a lot to people in prison, period, you know. You know, them letters, letting people, even if it's for that 1 second that they write down, I know that 1 second was all about me.
Since she'd been incarcerated, Monet wasn't allowed to visit Adrielle. For a year, it was only letters and phone calls. Despite the distance, they were committed to taking their relationship to the next level. Even before Monet's release, they'd begun marriage arrangements. Once outside, she kicked the wedding planning into high gear. The prison chaplain refused. The nearest courthouse mandated both parties had to be physically present to sign the documents. The Pennsylvania state prison system had no precedent for their circumstances.
The legal process was a pain in the butt because there was no policy set in place to marry, you know, an inmate and a former inmate that was in the same prison. You know, so no policies were set. So we was the first, from what I understand. She even wrote the White House.
I try everything.
She wrote Obama. She used to write and she used to send letters for me, you know what I mean, to show, you know what I mean, because sometimes I'll be writing my own letters. So I got a letter from the White House. I'm like, national security, what's going on? And then it was talking about that we have to start the process and see where it goes, and then they'll be able to jump in if need be. She went home. We got married, what, like about
six? I went home in July 2016, and we started the process soon after. In November 22nd, same year, we got married. It was fast, it was quick, 20 minutes about.
Yeah. We got married in the visiting room. I had to wear my brown set, my DOC, my state issue.
It looked nice though.
It looked nice because despite all of that, certain officers, you know, they let me go out there with Timberlands. They let me press my clothes. That's never happened before. They let me go out with Browns from population. Usually when you go to visiting room, you got to put a jumpsuit on.
And then in a visiting room, you had to put on like a slipper.
And slippers, yeah. They let me put Tim's.
Yeah, that was nice. I had a dress, a white dress. It wasn't fancy.
It was.
I tried to pull it off. I had the belt with the rhinestone.
I told everybody it was Versace.
It wasn't expensive, but...
Well, it was nice. I liked it.
Thank you.
Stephen and Satina also pursued marriage while Stephen was serving time. But Stephen's insecurities persisted.
I mean, from what I remember, right, the marriage came more from... From her perspective, right? I wasn't like, it's so like hard for me to say, like, as time went on, I kept just thinking, I'm going to get, you know, like a Dear John letter, or I'm going to call her and she's just going to be like, hey, I can't do this anymore. Because it's so rare that relationships last like beyond 5 years. I mean, I think that's just normal, even out here on in the streets, like in the public, right? But especially in there with all the different added stressors. And so I just approached each visit and each time with her is just that this is my special moment with her. I'm going to spend it now with her and I'm just going to enjoy it because I don't know when the last time, it'll be when, you know, when I get to see her again. And, yeah, but from my perspective, the marriage and more of the commitment side of the relationship came from her.
Satina, what made you decide to commit? What was that turning point where you said, I want to commit to this person for my life?
You know, I loved him and I didn't want to spend my life with anyone else. And so, yeah, it was me pushing. I know when I first brought up marriage, he was like, I don't know if I want to get married. Like, I don't want to do that to you. I'm never coming home. And I had basically told him, like, I understand your points, but this is what I want. I know what I'm getting myself into.
But things went beyond just marriage. Stephen and Satina had children while he was incarcerated. And as their daughters were entering their teens, Satina pushed for even more.
You know, I had first told him to apply for commutation and he didn't really think that they happened, you know, or if they did happen, it was for people who had political gain. But Governor Brown started commuting more and more people. And I would send him in the commutations and I'm like, please just apply for a commutation. And so I think with all my nagging, he decided to put in for a commutation.
So much life keeps happening, even though time seems to stand still when you're on the inside. For Stephen and Satina, that meant figuring out parenting. Most every weekend, Satina made the long drive with her two daughters to visit Stephen. In the visitation room, Stephen would work on school science projects, practice jujitsu, and just try to be as present a father as possible. By the time Stephen's commutation was approved, his oldest daughter was already in high school. In September 2019, Stephen left prison and joined his family. I know you're used to me talking to my parents on this show, but after so much time spent talking to Stephen and Satina, I really wanted to know more about the dynamics in their family. What was it like for their kids to grow up with a father serving a life sentence without parole? Did the decisions their parents made in the name of love make sense to them? Stephen and Satina's eldest daughter is 17-year-old Genesee. She says she's had to do a lot of adjusting throughout her parents' relationship.
Having an incarcerated parent is tough. You know, like, It depends on everyone's situation, though, because I know some parents aren't there for their kids at all, but I know that some parents, like my father, was there for me as much as he could be without, like, being overbearing, I guess. I guess now that he's out, I realize that it's tough, but, like, when he was inside still, I didn't really think much of it because it was, like, normal for me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it was just normal for me. Like, there was nothing, like, tough about it. Like, I mean, as I got older, I started to realize, like, oh, I don't want to go visit him anymore because it was a long drive. It was, like, 4 hours.
Mm.
And I was so tired of doing that drive, like, almost every weekend, every other weekend. I was like, I don't want to go see him. I don't want to go see him. But, I mean, once we got there, I was, like, happy to go see him. But it was just the drive that would kill me because I'm like, I don't want to go see you anymore.
Yeah.
I just want you to come home so that way we don't have to drive anymore.
You mentioned that can be kind of hard to talk about and it can bring up a lot and can be really emotional. Did you talk about it much with, like, friends when he was incarcerated? Was it something you felt comfortable talking about, or was it a part of your life that you kept a little more private?
Yeah, so I usually kept it private just because I know that a lot of people wouldn't understand. Like, they're like, oh, yeah, like, I'm so sorry. Like, I feel bad that you have to go through that. But they don't really understand what it's like to have, like, an incarcerated loved one. Like, even especially your parent. Like, it's different if it was, like, your uncle or your grandfather or whatever. But, like, that's my dad. That's my dad. Like, you probably have your dad at home. I don't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I usually kept it private. I wouldn't, because sometimes, especially when I was younger, I would just tell my friends, like, oh, my dad's at a business meeting or he's on a business trip. Like, he can't come because I would feel embarrassed. Like, I don't want to say that my dad's in prison. Like, why would I want to say that to my friends? Like, that's not something I'm proud of.
Is there, like, if there was another kid who was going through a similar experience, like, do you feel like you have any advice that you would want to give or anything you've learned from your own experience that you think could help someone else?
So I would probably say to them, like, things are going to feel weird. Things are going to get tough sometimes. But honestly, you should be really grateful for, like, them being home, because sometimes I'm not grateful because he's there all the time. But yeah, you have to be grateful for them being home instead of being where they were instead of, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Like, try to be present with them where they are and where you are right now.
Yeah, like, spend more time with them, even though sometimes they may get on your nerves or they might piss you off. I don't know, but I'm really grateful for them, so.
I would say I was like an alien being dropped off into another world, because I got incarcerated very young. I was 18 years old, so I didn't really know what it was like to be had no idea what it was like to be a husband or a father or just who I was, you know, without all, like, the political ramifications of prison.
Hmm.
Right? Like, inside we have a very structured world. We know what all the rules are. We know what happens if we break the rules. And we know what happens, like, when you're kind of, like, stuck, like, in an arrested development. Like, you have to remain who you were at the time you were incarcerated. And so when you're trying to grow past that, you kind of really don't. Even though you do change and things do change and things, people do understand different situations. But coming out is like, you have all these now, oh, I can do this. Oh, I can do that. They're just choices. And I don't have to ask permission to go to the bathroom, or I don't have to ask permission to go to the store. Like, I can just get in my car and drive somewhere. Very different reality for me. And then to deal with her expectations of who she not thought I was, but her expectations of the roles that I have to take. Like, husbands act this way, fathers do this. And, you know, for me, sometimes I'm like, well, it doesn't mean I have to, but that's a different conversation, I guess.
You know, as someone who's never been formally incarcerated, you don't realize how traumatic prison is for them.
Hmm.
And so I did have probably high expectations. I didn't think they were high expectations. You know, I thought, oh, this is easy. Like, you know, it's not that hard to do, or, but it actually is. Like, I didn't realize how prison really affects just everything on how everyone out here knows how to do things. And so it's different for him to have to learn how to use a cell phone. And I do see, I would get frustrated easily. Like, you know, you've been home for a few months now. Why aren't you getting it? And so I've tried to learn to have more patience. That doesn't always happen. But yeah, it definitely reentry is not what I expected. You know, and I didn't expect like a fairy tale. I knew there would be some ups and downs, but I just, I think for me, you know, it was a lot harder than what I thought reentry was going to be like for us.
How about negotiating intimacy? I mean, going from that environment where you're allowed to, you know, sit on the same side of the table and hold hands to an environment where, you know, you're living in the same house and you can be physically and emotionally intimate more often in whatever ways you want to. How did you all make that transition? That sounds difficult.
Yeah, I think for me it's funny that I always worried about that. Like when he comes home, like is he gonna want to be more sexually active than me? And it's to me, I think it's been quite the opposite. I'm wanting to have sex more often than he does. But I think we've come to a compromise, you know, so that we're both happy with our sex life.
So Tina and Steven are still trying to find the balance that prison prevented. For Audrielle and Monet, living together on the outside meant totally rebuilding the relationship that was based around prison rules and culture. Strangely, some of those rules followed them. Audrielle joined Monet in February 2020, just days before the world headed into a pandemic lockdown.
You know, a lot of them letters were talking about our future. You know, hey, we want to do this, and hey, we want to do that, and let's do this. And so far, we've been getting it done. We went to California. I've never been to New York. We went to New York. We went to Baltimore. I mean, we're fulfilling what we spoke about years ago. It's taking a little time, but we're getting there, you know?
Inside or outside, relationships take work, and it goes both ways. I always said, you know, with Steven, it was easier because I was the one that constantly gave, and he always took. And now that he's home, he's learning how to give, and I'm learning how to take. So it's not such a one-sided relationship anymore.
Is there anything about their connection and their love and dynamic that you hope for your own future?
There's probably a lot, but not the prison part. I don't know. Their love is literally unexplainable. Like, I'm so serious. Like, I can't explain the way that they love each other. I just know that I would want that for like myself, for my own relationship in the future. They're both so caring, and I love that about them. I love that they care for each other, not even just like for each other, but for everyone. Like, they want to see everyone succeed, and they want to do good. Like, they're such good people.
That's so beautiful. I'm sure it would mean a lot for them to hear you say that.
I hope they don't hear
Well, if you're listening to this
that.
podcast, turn it off.
Yeah, don't listen to this anymore, guys. Turn it off.
So Tina and Stephen Green celebrated 17 years of marriage in March. Stephen is pursuing his education full time, and Satina is the communications manager at Restore Justice, an advocacy organization that works to end life and extreme sentences. Monet and Adriel Alvarado will celebrate 5 years of marriage in November. They live and work together in Philadelphia. My thanks to Grant Hall of Mormon and Charlie Shelton Orman for producing this episode. This show is sponsored by Weaver Street Market, a worker and consumer-owned cooperative selling organic and local food at four Triangle locations in North Carolina. Now featuring online shopping with next-day pickup. WeaverStreetMarket.coop. Embodied is a production of North Carolina Public Radio WUNC, a listener-supported station. If you want to lend your support to this podcast and WUNC's other shows on demand, consider a contribution at WUNC.org now. Incredible storytelling like you hear on Embodied is only possible because of listeners like you. Lindsay Foster Thomas is WUNC's Director of Content. Jenny Lawson is our sound engineer. Quilla wrote our theme music. Special thanks to Melissa Radcliffe and our friends at Ear Hustle for their help with this episode. And this is our season two finale. If this is your first time listening, or if you've been rocking with Embodied from the beginning, thank you. Hosting the show and the kind of conversations we welcome on it have opened my eyes, heart, and the door to opportunities I never imagined. One happened very recently. I was asked to give the commencement address to the Women and Gender Studies Department at my alma mater, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. In my address, I share three lessons I've learned in the decade since leaving that program. Here's a small sample of the words I chose to share with that graduating class.
I told you that I'm an analyzer and a thinker. It may not surprise you to know that I'm also a planner. I love a plan. But as I've learned over the course of the past 10 years, the opportunities that have been most worth it, the moments that have been most life-giving, didn't come because I thought and planned my way into them, but instead because I was forced or encouraged by a deadline or circumstance to take a leap of faith, make a decision, and trust that when it came time to make another decision, I'd find a way to do it that aligned with my values and priorities in the moment. Each of these decisions, moments, and leaps of faith were the product of lessons that I've learned and relearned, but ones that this very program helped lay the foundation for, and ones I'd love to share with you today. Number one, embrace periods of stretch and periods of rest. Feminist activism, in whatever form you engage in it, will require you to stretch. You'll stretch to step outside your comfort zone and have a difficult conversation with someone in hopes of getting them to see a new perspective. You'll stretch to organize a conference, a rally, or a reading group. You'll stretch when someone else's activism shows you your own blind spots. This stretch is good. It is where the growth happens. It's where you create and share and engage, but it cannot be your constant state. I've noticed that it's only when I rest can I really integrate everything that I've learned. When I step back from the noise for a minute, I can see where I need to heal parts of myself to go back out and keep doing good work. When I rest, I can figure out the difference between productivity for the sake of productivity and work that's enriching for myself and others. And even more important than all of that, rest is in itself activism. Capitalism, colonialism, and patriarchy send us messages that we're not worthy of rest, that we must keep producing. Those messages take us away from ourselves. They trap us in guilt, shame, and judgment, and they disconnect us from our inner wisdom. This program in the past 4 years has taught you about the beauty of stretch. And to honor all of that stretching that you've done and will continue to do, I hope you also make time for rest.